From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Call me Captain Obvious, but we live in some very uncertain times. And when stress is high, sometimes you just want something familiar.
Everybody understands it's crispy bread and melty cheese. And where you go from there is anybody's game.
That's LA chef Eric Greenspan. We've been talking about one of his comforts, the Humble Grilled Cheese Sandwich. The grilled cheese isn't just a nostalgic favorite. It's a blank slate for all kinds of mad creations. Eric's here with some inspiration from his forthcoming book. It's called The Great American Grilled Cheese Book. So I have to tell you, I'm flipping through your book and I see a photograph that looks like homemade cheese.
Yeah.
In an aluminum container. And I'm like, no, don't tell me that he starts out by, okay, here's this grilled cheese book, but first you have to make your own cheese.
Out of the gate.
So is that so you get to have something that's based on real cheese with real flavor, but has a different melting point?
I mean, look, that's the whole basis for processed cheese in general. I mean, processed cheese has changed to what it is now, but processed cheese in general was a way to use kind of scrap cheeses and to increase the melting point to make it more melty and delicious. You know, for me, the chapters I wanted to divide it by was by cheeses, and I said, let's lead with American cheese, but I couldn't find a way to make it, you know, this book spans the gamut of being of fun and chefy. And so for me, I had to make the American cheese section somewhat chefy. I didn't know how to do it. So I made my own American cheese.
How hard is it?
It's super easy. I mean, especially the way that I did it. I mean, the way I did it was, you know, I didn't do the whole sodium citrate emulsifier chemical situation that you see a lot today. I mean, that you've been seeing since Kraft started. I did tapioca. So you basically take cheese and milk and butter and whatever flavors. We made a sriracha one, we made a maple one, we make a beer one.
You made a pimento cheese one.
We made a pimento cheese one, yeah. The pimento cheese one really wound up coming out like pimento cheese, like a spread. The other ones really set up nice and firm and sliceable like American cheese. Same melting point, same flavor. You basically take cheddar cheese or any cheese, frankly, heat up the milk, put it all in a blender together, throw in some tapioca, blend it together, put it in a pan, let it set, American cheese.
It's the starch that changes everything.
Exactly. So typically, traditionally, they use emulsifiers. That's what the sodium citrate is. First of all, I don't think the book is about being able to make the things that are in the book.
Right.
And it's not like everyone's like, oh, let's go to the store and buy some sodium citrate. But everybody knows what tapioca is. And I wanted you to feel good about what you were cooking. And I don't know, you wouldn't give your kid a spoonful of sodium citrate, but you'd give your kid a spoonful of tapioca.
This all started, this particular obsession of yours, all started with a sandwich called the Champ. Could you remind us about the Champ?
The Champ started at the Foundry on Melrose, my little small restaurant on Melrose that we opened back in yesteryear. And it was kind of a derivation on a cheese plate. We took raisin walnut bread. We made an apricot caper puree. We put some arugula, some what started off as oven-dried tomatoes. It is now basically sun-dried tomatoes for this incantation. And then we took Taleggio cheese. I wanted a nice, stinky, kind of cheese-boardy cheese. We put some Taleggio on there. And then, you know, we served short ribs as one of the staples on the menu. And so we would have all these little scraps left over on the side. So we would just shred that up and put it on the grilled cheese. And it was just called the Taleggio and short rib grilled cheese on raisin walnut bread until we entered into the long-lost grilled cheese invitational, I think in like 2011. And then we won. And so we said, let's call it the Champ.
So last year, I had booked a wedding, a catering job, and I was confronted in my prep with making hundreds of tuna melts.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I reached out to you for production advice. So can you take us through the basics of what we need to think about when we're making an excellent grilled cheese sandwich?
Let's see.
Let's start with the bread, which these days, there's so much great bread out there, but a lot of times there's giant holes in it.
Yeah, exactly. I always say, and certain people cringe when I say it, but I say use good bread and not great bread because, you know, there's been such a revolution in great artisanal baking. But the reality of it is that with the fancy starters and the blah, 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 you get these holes that don't allow for real even browning. And to me, a grilled cheese has got to be, you know, it's got to be golden straight across. Not that I'm against Wonder Bread, to be honest. But, you know, I like to use a good bread that's got a good tooth and it's got interesting components to it, some good flavors and stuff like that.
Is this one instance where actually having a dedicated apparatus yields better results, or can we make a really great sandwich on a pan?
I mean, I was watching Benny and June the other day and was reminded of the scene where Johnny Depp used the iron.
It's a great idea.
It's a great idea. No, you could use an iron. Look, apparatus, sure. But look, I think grilled cheese cooks great in a pan. I think a griddle works really well. The difference is, are you buttering the pan or are you buttering the bread?
Are we buttering the bread or are we buttering the pan?
When I use a griddle, I butter the bread. And when I use a pan, I butter the pan. And I like using a pan a little bit more because I get to drop the bread in, I get to drop the butter in and start to brown it a little bit and get that kind of nuttiness and that brown butter flavor and then drop the bread in. And then right before I flip it, I throw some more butter in and flip it. To me, it's just a more interesting way of cooking.
Do you have the sandwich pre-built when you put it in the pan, or do you create the sandwich in layers on top of the bread that's in the pan?
Typically, I pre-build. There are times that I will start with the bread and build it depending on kind of the complexity of it. I think in the book, most of the time we pre-build all of the sandwiches and then we cook them. I mean, look, the fun part about this book is like, let's not overthink it.
Yeah, you say it's not a Bible and the recipes aren't meant to be law.
And it's a grilled cheese sandwich. So are there great ways to cook a grilled cheese? Sure. But I'm pretty sure you're going to figure it out one way or another.
So let's talk about the cheeses. Is there any cheese that was not meant to be in a grilled cheese sandwich?
Yes and no. I mean, I think definitely you need to stay away from hard, well-aged cheeses, frankly, because they don't melt and they don't have enough moisture in them so that when they do melt, no matter if you hammer them enough, they will eventually melt. But when they do, they're just going to break and get kind of oily and nasty. But those still have a place in grilled cheese sandwiches. Like, for example, Parmesan. For me, I love to grate Parmesan and put it on the outside of the grilled cheese and then make like kind of a crust.
So let's talk about a couple different types. So let's talk about washed rind cheeses, bloomy cheeses.
Yeah, love them.
I mean, so many of us love them.
Yeah. Those are my favorite cheeses for grilled cheeses.
Really?
Like the Taleggio, like a Brie, or like a triple cream, because they melt super easy. I think in the book I recommend taking off the rind, but frankly, you can leave the rind on.
I love the rind.
Yeah, and give it that, and they just got so much funk going on to them. When you can feel the cheese, that's a good cheese.
So let's talk about the Elvis.
Ah.
So Elvis famously loved peanut butter, bacon, and banana sandwiches. Mm-hmm. But you do something interesting with the peanut butter.
Yeah. The Elvis sandwich is a sandwich. It is not a grilled cheese. I wanted to include, I mean, look, I love Elvis. You know, at the Foundry where we did live music, every Halloween, I used to dress up like Elvis. And I used to do a full set. So I'm a big Elvis fan, and I wanted to include the Elvis sandwich in it. The book is also kind of sub-separated by, like, vegetarian, meat, breakfast, sweets. And so there's a lot of sandwiches here that are great for dessert because I think that grilled cheese makes for a great dessert at times. So what I do is I take the peanut butter and the goat cheese, and you mix them. And A, therefore, it becomes a grilled cheese. But also you get the beautiful balance of, like, that nutty sweetness from the peanut butter and that acidity and creaminess from the goat cheese.
What about cheeses that are harder and can get strong, like Gouda?
I mean, to me, I think Gouda works really well. Again, and that's the kind of the fun thing about the book is, like, for me, strength begets strength. So when you're using a really strong cheese, like a Gouda, I like to include that in sandwiches that have a lot of stuff going on. For example, like the Gobbler. The Gobbler is my take on Thanksgiving. On that Thanksgiving leftover sandwiches. So there's a lot going on in there. There's leftover turkey. There's green beans, the green bean casserole. There's a cranberry olive chutney, which is like all up in your face, delicious, salty and bright and the whole thing. And so it works really well with a Gouda because a Gouda is nice and strong.
Where can people find your food these days?
Where can people find my food these days? That's a good question because we're constantly on the move. I still have the Roof on Wilshire. I've had that restaurant for about 6 years on the roof of the Hotel Wilshire. In fact, we're in the process of doing a whole dramatic remodel and reshift of the menu and stuff like that, which is exciting. It's been around for like 6 years, and so it's time for a little upgrade again, and that's exciting. What I've been spending a lot of my time on is in the virtual world. I've been working on a delivery-only concept incubator for like the past 6 months. And then you might be asking yourself, And what does that mean?
Well, is that connected to Uber in any way?
We use Uber. It's through Uber Eats. It's through Postmates. It's through Grubhub.
And what is the name?
Right now, I've got one kitchen in a building called Cloud Kitchens. In this kitchen, I've got three virtual restaurants coming out of the same kitchen. So instead of having different restaurants to have to go to for different concepts, I have all the concepts coming out of one kitchen because there's no storefront. So what you see on Uber Eats or on my websites or on Postmates are these different restaurants, but they're all coming out of the same kitchen. So I've got one called Two on a Roll, which is my ode to the New York City bodega breakfast sandwich, you know, bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches, et cetera. But we make our own chorizo, we make our own sausage, stuff like that. A lot of fun. I've got one called Brecky's Breakfast Burritos, which is a breakfast burrito concept, and it's got yogurt bowls, and it's got breakfast bowls, and hash brown nuggets, and stuff like that. And then I've got one called Chino, Home of the Orange Chicken Burrito, where we're doing basically Asian Latin fusion.
Hey, Eric.
Yes, Evan.
Thank you so much for competing on Guy's Grocery Games for us.
My absolute pleasure.
And even more, thank you for winning.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure.
That's Chef Eric Greenspan, past winner of the Grilled Cheese Invitational. We've been talking about his new book, which is called The Great Grilled Cheese Book, Grown-Up Recipes for a Childhood Classic. It's on pre-order now. It comes out August 7th. Coming up, my conversation with Matt Goulding about his food explorations in Italy. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. If you're a Good Food listener, you've probably had this daydream. You know, the one where you quit your day job and travel the world, eating your way through new countries? Well, I know someone who's actually managed to turn his nomadic ways into a career.
The challenge, Evan, of course, writing about Italy is finding something new to say about one of the most chronicled food cultures in the world.
That's Matt Goulding. He's a James Beard Award-winning food writer who's authored really wonderful books about his food travels to places like Spain and Japan. His newest is a beautiful love letter to Italy called Pasta, Pane, Vino. Just a note, this was recorded before the passing of Anthony Bourdain, who's mentioned toward the end of the interview. It's great to have you back. I understand that you're in one of my favorite places. Where are you?
I am in Tokyo, staring out into Shibuya right now.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
Sorry, earmuffs, please, next time. No, I mean, it's an incredible place to be, and I kind of fell in love with this country for the first book that we did, which was rice noodle fish, and so we keep coming back here as much as possible.
What are some of your Japanese snacks while I have you on?
You know, I've become a lover of onigiri, like of ikura onigiri, which is the salmon eggs.
Let's talk about Pasta, Pane, Vino. It's the next installment in your series of travel cookbooks. You did one, you just mentioned, rice noodle fish about Japan, and you did grape olive pig, which was Spain. The thing I love about these books is that they truly are this quirky combination of storytelling, travel guide, and sort of food deep dive. Let's talk about the middle of nowhere, because I've been in the middle of nowhere so many times in Italy and found that it's like one of the best places to be. So I'm curious which middles of nowhere you chronicle in the book.
You're absolutely right. The middle of nowhere is where you want to be in Italy, in particular in the world of agriturismos, which are just an amazing way to see the country. I mean, you could do much worse than literally planning an entire trip, hopping from one agriturismo to the next. And that goes for as much in the Piedmont as it does down in Sicily. I happen to think that the middle of nowheres in Sicily and in Sardinia are especially nowhere, in the sense that they're very isolated and very high quality reflections of the cuisine and of the food culture in general. So, you know, we stayed at some incredible agriturismos along the northern coast of Sicily that I write about in the book where, you know, it's not just simply a place to stay and eat. It's a full culinary education into the local terroir, into the traditions that drive every element of the food chain. I mean, I think that's the way to truly experience Italy if you're a serious eater.
And what I love about the agriturismi, which of course combine the world of agriculture and tourism, is that it's such a reflection of the Italian culture, even now, when one would think that everything is very removed from the land.
They have maintained the ethos. I mean, they're by law, they must survive off of, I believe, 50% of their sales must be agriculturally based in one way or another. Actually, it could be higher than that. And so that means, you know, you must be growing fruits to make marmalades or olives to press oil or raising animals for making cheese and butter. Those are baked into the very definition of an agriturismo. And in fact, there's a chapter that's dedicated to a different species called an ititurismo, which is a place that where at least half of your business is dedicated to fisheries. In this case, it's on the shores of Lake Como, run by a husband and a wife who have a small trattoria outside of Bellagio in a tiny little town called San Giovanni. And every single morning at 4 a.m., the husband, Alessandro, wakes up and he casts his net into Lake Como. And whatever he pulls out is then transformed into lunch, into dinner, and into long-term staples that they sell at their bed and breakfast, essentially.
What I love so much about that essay and those photographs is, for so many people, Lake Como is just this place of like the bella vita, you know, the life of like George Clooney and other fantastic luminaries who live in those amazing palazzi along the lake. But it's also a place, a region where just regular people live.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what we're kind of trying to get at there. I mean, I think Alessandro has this perfect little anecdote that I think encapsulates that exact notion there. He was out one day fishing along the shores. It just happened to be close to Signore Clooney's, you know, sprawling villa there. And the police come up and they tell him to move along. No paparazzi here. And he goes, paparazzi, what are you talking about? I'm a fisherman. This happens to be where the best perch on the lake are. Get away from here.
What an intersection. You also profile people, and they're just regular people. But I think for me, this is like the way into travel is just to talk to whoever you find. So tell me a little bit about a couple of your everyday culinary heroes. Let's start with Mamma Lea.
So, I mean, the idea with the everyday culinary heroes was that when you do deep dives and essays into sort of people who are at the intersection of transformation of a cuisine, you often end up profiling chefs. But we really, especially in Italy, as we all know, the sort of the conduits of the cuisine are the women at home cooking. And in particular, the mamme and the nonne who have long driven the sort of heart of the cuisine. So we profiled five different older women in particular across the spectrum of Italy. And so in particular here, Mamma Lea, she's from Abruzzo. And, you know, we just asked them different questions. I just wanted to talk to them about sort of who their kitchen heroes were, what their favorite food moments were. So, when I asked her, you know, who her kitchen hero was, she said it was her daughter, who happened to be a phenomenal cook. She says, oh, she's my inspiration. You know, of course, the irony of that or the funny part about that is if you talk to her daughter about who her hero is, of course, it's Mamma Lea. It goes back and forth in that sort of beautiful, sort of virtuous cycle.
When you approach a new project like this Italian project, do you plan out everything or do you allow yourself time to get lost?
Definitely allow time to get lost. I mean, I think in the case of all three of these books in this series, I think the approach was, let's spend 3 months, and I say let's. My wife comes with me everywhere. She's my right hand in all of this and has been sort of an amazing asset and travel companion along the way. But spend 3 months kind of getting lost, you know, with a rough idea of where you want to go, eating and drinking and meeting people and having the conversations, and then pulling back and saying, okay, here's kind of what I'm seeing now. You know, I really want to hit on different notes, different sides of the cuisine. And so, you know, I want to do something that was very traditional, which was the ragu culture of Bologna and really of Emilia-Romagna. And so that meant going back to Emilia-Romagna and speaking with as many different people as possible. That meant meeting probably 10 different nonne, the grandmothers who have been making ragu their whole life, and then going to Osteria Francescana and having Massimo Bottura's 82 euro plate of tagliatelle a ragu. and figuring out what this all means. What does this say about this part of the country, these particular people who have long ascribed to this, you know, very special and sacred tradition? But then pulling back and saying, you know what, like, that's a deep dive into a single dish. Maybe we need something a little bit more freewheeling, a little bit more adventurous and swashbuckling. And so we decided to go up to the Piedmont, and I did a sort of a hike, a 7-day hike through the Lange, which is the Alba area, which is probably one of the great culinary concentrations of the world. You've got Alba truffles, you've got the incredible hazelnuts, you have, of course, Barolo and Barbaresco right there in the area. And I found out through a friend that you can actually just take a little backpack and hike from one village to the next. And we did a loop around what I think is one of the most magnificent culinary terrains of the world. That chapter is really a high-paced, sort of fun, movable feast. And I think that's the key for me personally, is to kind of tell a varied and textured tale of Italian cuisine.
Well, I envy you that this is your job. I shouldn't envy you because I have a pretty great job too. But
yes, but, you do.
But being able to travel for 3 months at a time is pretty incredible.
It's extraordinary luxury. And like I say constantly to my wife, if we ever wake up and complain, then we're pretty much idiots, because this is, I mean, from a professional standpoint, as good as it gets. You know, you make deep inroads into a country, you meet a lot of incredible people. And it's not just about having delicious food, of course, that's wonderful. But you find yourself really, truly changed and transformed by these places. That's why I'm in Tokyo calling you right now, because I fell so deeply in love with this country working on this book that I couldn't possibly stay away for longer than 6 months at a time. So I'm constantly coming back here. And that's going to be the challenge, though. That list of places just keeps growing.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. But that's the beauty of the world. Your book is an Anthony Bourdain book. It's an imprint of Harper. What is his involvement at this point with the books?
Sure. I mean, start by saying that Mr. Bourdain is a part owner of Roads and Kingdoms, has long been a collaborator with us at the sort of the media company that I co-founded with my partner, Nathan. And so we've kind of long sort of conspired editorially to do different projects together. Now, Tony has been running an imprint at HarperCollins for a number of years, and we, you know, came to him with this idea. And when he finds people who he likes to collaborate with, he likes to give them plenty of freedom. Whenever you ask Tony for recommendations or ideas, in particular in a country like Italy, where he has really deep roots, we always begin the book with a little bit of an exchange, you know, a back and forth series of letters that we send to each other about the place in question. It's fun to hear his perspective, which was, you know, me telling him, hey, Tony, I'm seeing a lot of new things going on over here. People are starting to slowly evolve this cuisine in a way that I haven't seen before. And he's basically, hey, man, don't mess with my cacio e pepe.
I've been speaking with James Beard Award-winning writer Matt Goulding. Matt's the co-founder of Roads and Kingdoms, which won the 2017 James Beard Award. We've been talking about his latest book, Pasta Pane Vino, an account of his food travels to Italy. There's travel, then there's love, like when you become infatuated with the place, almost as you would with a person. That happened to me in Italy when I was 17, but as I got older, that love changed and matured, as with any relationship. I began making friends there who showed me new sides of Italy. Elizabeth Minchilli is one of them.
But if you make the effort to go off the main alleyways, away from San Marco, away from the main monuments, you find the restaurants that the Venetians are still going to, and they might not even look like much. They might look like a bar that only sells wine, and they might only serve things in the middle of the day. But that's where, for instance, you and I found the most delicious dishes.
Elizabeth Minchilli and I met 25 years ago when I was organizing a culinary tour in Italy. Since then, we've shared countless hours eating, shopping, and cooking together. I've seen her girls grow up beautiful and strong. Elizabeth isn't just one of my closest friends. She also happens to be a beloved Italian lifestyle writer. She recently wrote her 8th book called Eating My Way Through Italy. You didn't always write about food-centered things. What did you start writing about?
Well, I came to Italy as an art historian. And when I first started writing for magazines, I naturally started writing about art and architecture and design and garden design for the first few years of my career.
And what caused you to veer off into food?
Well, I always was interested in food. I was interested in eating food. I was interested in cooking food. As I started writing about culture for magazines, I found that I could find the sort of cultural intersection between food and culture. And I was invited on several press trips along with you, as you know. And I sort of started meeting more people in the food world and realized that I could start writing for Food and Wine and Bon Appetit and not necessarily write just about food, but also about culture and travel.
You have been living in Italy for how long? 30 years?
Oh, God. Yeah, at least. I've been off and on since 1972, which is way too long to count.
So 1972, you were a child. What took you there then and how long did you stay?
Well, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and my father went to Italy with my mom for the first time. They did Florence, Venice, Rome, came back home, sold our business, sold our house, and we moved to Rome just for 2 years, which was fantastic. It was a little bit upsetting at first because I was 12 years old, but I obviously loved it and was always looking for a way to come back. And I finally did that as an art historian, as a graduate student.
And you quickly met a man.
I did. I was just sort of getting to the point where I would have to come back to the States and deal with getting a career in academia when I met Domenico, an Italian architect. And within a year, I had a husband, and he was Italian, an Italian daughter, Italian dog, and I had this new career writing for magazines.
Although we all grow up thinking that we have a great love of food and enjoying eating, there's such a huge difference between the place of food in American culture then, not now, before the food circus started, mm-hmm. and the place food has always had in Italian culture. Talk to me a little bit about Domenico's family and Bari, which is where he's from, and your connections to the food culture of that area.
Well, it was really interesting for me because my family grew up loving food as well, but in a completely different way, as you pointed out. We were always interested in what we were having for dinner, what was the next meal. But then when I married Domenico and we started going down to Bari, which is in Puglia in the south of Italy, I was part of a different family structure, obviously, one that was really Italian. And it was the first time that I really learned to cook in somebody else's kitchen. Because I feel like when I was growing up, yes, my mom cooked, but I was really the one cooking most of the time, too. And instead, there was somebody else's kitchen I was stepping into, and it was the first time that I sort of had to stand back and I could learn something from somebody else in my own home, which was Domenico's home.
Let's talk about another place in which you spend quite a lot of time. You live in Rome, but you have a second home that started out quite rough. I remember it many, many years ago in Umbria, near the town of Todi. What's the appeal of Umbria?
The appeal of Umbria. Well, I think for a lot of people, their first time in Umbria, you drive through this landscape and you say, oh my God, this looks like a Renaissance painting. And in fact, it's where Raphael was, you know, raised and Perugino. So a lot of the paintings that you see, this is in fact the backdrop. And since Umbria was a poor region for so long and so isolated, a lot of the landscape remains the same. And so you've got these rolling hills. It's very green. It's called the Green Heart of Italy because it's so forested. But then the forests alternate with fields and it's a very soft landscape. And again, the food is fantastic.
Yeah, for me, it's always been, the appeal of it has always been that it's extremely human scale.
I agree. It's very human scale. You know, you have a hill, but then there's always a castle on it or a village, and you can hear the bells ringing. It's not so wild that it feels alienating. It's very human.
One of the hallmarks of this particular book of yours is the way the itineraries flow in and out of stories about people and stories about the food with recipes. And you talk about places that aren't on people's top five or top 10 hit list. They're sort of, to a lot of people, they would be the middle of nowhere, like Bevagna, for example.
The whole point of this book, I think today, a real luxury is finding yourself alone in a place. You know, it used to be the luxury was getting to the place like Rome or Venice or Florence, and that is still quite a luxury. But these days, when you get to those places and you're surrounded by so many people and you're trying to search out some sort of authentic experience or an experience that still reflects a local culture, that gets more and more difficult, I think, today. So my aim in this book was to recount some of my personal experiences that I had that were special because I felt like I was discovering a culture that has existed in the same way for hundreds of years. And in a place like Bavagna, which is a small town in Umbria, or even on an island outside in the Venetian Lagoon, you know, which is relatively close to Piazza San Marco, but then, you know, there's a rooster crowing, there's the bells are tolling, and you're the only person in the piazza.
So in Umbria, for example, give me an idea of where you love to stop to eat.
Oh, one of my favorite places is actually a truck stop. And I've been going to the town of Deruta for a long time, and this is a town that's known for their ceramics, their brightly painted ceramics. And it was always hard to find a place to eat because I would ask the people who were making ceramics, where should I go? And they'd send me this fancy place, that fancy place, a hotel in the next town over, which was never really that satisfying. And one day I asked somebody who was actually painting them the ceramics, where are you going? And he said, oh, you don't want to go where I go. And it ended up being the restaurant behind the gas station on the main street of town, which is fantastic. And, you know, they make this wonderful truffle sausage pasta, which is now one of my favorite places to go.
So I understand that you found out by accident that your dog is a truffle hunter.
Yes, Pico the truffle hound. I was sitting in the kitchen one day. I woke up earlier than most of my family. I was having coffee. I'd let the dog out. It's about 6 o'clock in the morning. I hear this tap, tap, tap. I look at the window. There's Pico with his mouth full of what I thought was a dead bird or something. And so I go with a paper towel. I go over, have him open his mouth, and it just pop, and a truffle comes out of his mouth. And he just was so happy to give it to me. And I have no idea how he decided he was a truffle dog. In Umbria, there are truffle dogs. We adopted him from a pound. Maybe he was hanging out with other truffle dogs in the woods. I don't know. He found that truffle. He found one more later in the week. And then that was the end of his truffle career.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I mean, it's so rare that you come out to the West Coast. I'm thrilled to have you, even for a short period of time.
Well, it was great to come and talk to you about eating my way through Italy, and I hope you come back soon and join me.
I've been talking with my dear friend Elizabeth Minchilli about her 8th book called Eating My Way Through Italy. Coming up, we turn to Vespertine, the restaurant that Jonathan Gold ranked best in L.A. last year. My conversation with Chef Jordan Kahn when we return. It's Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Last year, you might have raised an eyebrow or two when the LA Times released Jonathan Gold's list of LA's 101 best restaurants. By that, I mean his number one ranked restaurant, the newcomer Vespertine in Culver City.
We like to sort of create sort of a world for the guests where they feel like they're their protagonists.
That's Jordan Kahn, chef of Vespertine. Vespertine's a fine dining restaurant, but none like you've seen before. It's housed in this amazing four-story structure that almost looks like a giant steel waffle. The restaurant's been called a work of art, not only for its architecture, but also its highly experiential approach to dining. The restaurant recently hit its one-year mark, so I wanted to get Jordan's thoughts about how the year has gone. The restaurant website reads, Vespertine is a gastronomical experience seeking to disrupt the course of the modern restaurant. Do you feel like you have accomplished that vision?
I think that the idea of that is that the work is never done. There's never going to be a moment where we sort of check that box. It's sort of a constant evolving sort of being as we see it. And so I think we are very sort of proud of a lot of the things that we've accomplished just sort of internally with our own ideology and then, you know, with obviously our guests and things like that. So
how important was creating a mythology for the dining experience?
I would say creating a mythology was really more for creating the restaurant, actually, because we included so many different types of people from various backgrounds. I wanted it to have a sense that it feels very cohesive, but at the hands of many people doing things that sort of untethered, sort of in their own right. And so we had to sort of create a mythology that we would hand to these various artists and say, fill this with what you think would be appropriate.
So I love that. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's famously Eric Owen Moss is the
That's
architect
right.
of the building and a partner. You know, when I think about presenting food to the diner, I think about the role of the plate, which is a conveyance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's a vehicle for display. In my experience eating at Vespertine, perhaps the most disruptive part was your desire to make people find the food, that it's kind of like a hide and seek.
Yeah.
So the vessels kind of obfuscate rather than display.
That's right. There's a couple that do that. And I think that when you are seated for an extended period of time through a menu, we like to sort of create sort of a world for the guests where they feel like they're their protagonists. And then, no pun intended, we don't necessarily want to spoon feed them. The courses are sort of, there's an act of sort of, you know, giving them the opportunity to seek it out. When you do that, you create different feelings from the guest perspective, and sort of like, you're going to have to actually be a part of this thing. You know, we're not just kind of, you're not a voyeur, you're a protagonist. So therefore you need to sort of be part of the story as well.
So did that idea of the customer being a protagonist come from the experience you had of that play, Sleep No More?
Sleep No More was a big inspiration in the sense of the scope of it was just extraordinary.
Describe what it was.
So for those who haven't been, it's essentially a play that is housed inside a hotel. But the play is happening on multiple floors through different characters. And you, as a voyeur, get to sort of go wherever you want and get to watch whatever scene. But there's no stage. You are in the stage. You're in the world. And everybody has a mask on so that you are purposefully separated from your group when you arrive, so that it really creates this individualized experience. And that was the part that had the biggest impact on me, which is, oh, they don't want everybody having the same experience. It's the opposite. They want everybody having their own personal journey, their own personal discovery. And that was massively impactful. And so there are some elements of that we have really been inspired by for Vespertine. Now we've taken it in a much more soft, much more passive way than Sleep No More. Some of it's pretty intense. But in terms of the dining experience is not linear. We sort of take everybody through the same course, but your experience with your guests are going to feel very different than the experience of everybody else's, which is why if you'd read 10 people's accounts of the meal, it's all different.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's amazing. I mean, it shows that you as a diner play a significant role in determining what your experience is going to be. Now, with that comes some, you know,
tension.
Right. But I think that ultimately, in terms of creating a project that really does expand the idea of dining and the idea of what a restaurant is, I think that's a big one.
You started out as a pastry chef.
That's right.
A part of the meal that is pretty much universally considered to be the delicious punctuation at the end of a meal.
Right.
Your palette of food throughout the meal is really fascinating. You do this dance with sour and bitter. So I'm just curious, what is your relationship with deliciousness?
I've been asked that. I have a great relationship. I mean, it's, you know, I think we look at the menu as sort of I mean, the way the menu is constructed, it's more of a visual narrative to begin to start with. So I sort of start with a group of sketches and one dish, how we start sort of informs the next. So it's sort of writing a story and then but in a sort of really abstract way, and then applying it in the sense of, I'll give you an example, is one of our first menus, sort of the very first course that you would receive was essentially a bowl that looked like it was empty, and it was all black, and it was sort of beginning from nothing. So I was like, well, how do we start this meal? It's like, well, we got to start from zero. So that was sort of the idea behind the first course. And then the second course was its polar opposite, which was very vertical, very white, and sort of like, this is sort of the end of it. So it wasn't just, it was, you know, in the beginning there was blackness, and then the Big Bang hit, and everything was bright.
Talk to me about the relationship of aroma and the experience when you're leaving the restaurant.
In coming up with the guest's journey, we wanted to give them a parting gift that was not quite so fleeting as a pastry or a bag of cookies or a muffin for the next morning, which is certainly wonderful, but it is nonetheless fleeting. And especially if you have, you know, experiencing a long meal and you're very full, sort of you don't really want to see another piece of food at that moment. And so what I thought about was, how do we capture this memory and distill it and give it to somebody? This is a memory in a little vial. And we all kind of understand our sense of scent is directly linked to our memory. And so we created this idea of a fragrance that's used throughout the meal, but in a very subtle way so that the guests can pick up on it, but they don't really know that that's why it's there. It's like, oh, this towel smells nice. And it's also used to scent the soap in the restrooms and scent the elevator. And we scent the welcome napkins and a lot of these things. And a lot of the actual ingredients of the scent are used throughout the meal in different ways. And then so when you leave, it's like, by the way, you've been smelling this all night, but you didn't really, maybe you weren't paying attention to it. And this vial contains the memory. So in 6 months from now, when you spray it, it'll bring you back to this place.
When you talked at the beginning, the opening of the restaurant, you often sort of took pains to separate Vespertine from the fine dining experience that is married to place or to landscape. Yet you do play with foraging. Talk to me a bit about that tension.
I wish you would ask all of the questions all of the time. These are wonderful. You hit the nail on the head. It's not that we're distancing ourselves ideologically. We're sort of distancing ourselves in the sense of labeling, because as we know, labels are hard to shake, especially when one's stuck. So what we tried to do is almost coat ourselves with an oil slick so that every time somebody would put a label on us, it would just fall right off. Because this thing is not one thing. It's multidisciplinary. So to really define it should be a difficult one. It's even hard for me to describe. Hey, what's your restaurant? It's like, how much time you have? I don't. But we are undeniably influenced by our surroundings. Los Angeles is a place that is my home because I chose it. I've been here for over a decade. The very first day I arrived in this city was the day I moved in. I was working for Michael Mina at the time, and I came from San Francisco, and I know there's a bit of a north-south kind of...
Just
a little. And before I left San Francisco, everyone would tell me, like, oh, you're going to hate L.A., it sucks, it's, you know, it's all concrete and highways. And when I got there, first thing I noticed was the aroma. As soon as I opened the door, I was like, oh, my God, it smells like orange blossoms. And that has always stuck with me, and I describe Los Angeles is Hawaii with highways. It's like the most extraordinarily beautiful place anywhere. And it's so prolific. And, you know, I just love seeing little points of tension where there's like, you know, asphalt that's been, has a crack in it. And then there's a dandelion shooting out of it. And it's like, it will not be kept at bay. And so using a lot of the local flora and fauna and ingredients is critical. I mean, we live in a very rare and prolific place filled with an abundance of wonderful things. I mean, if we don't use it, we're jerks.
Thank you so much, Jordan.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jordan Kahn, chef of Vespertine, which recently marked its 1-year anniversary. After the break, we're talking with Marion Nessel about her long career in food advocacy. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman.
The more we know about food, the more we're going to be involved in what's going on in the world. It seems to me it's critical.
That's Food Studies Professor Marion Nessel. She's a leading voice for food justice and has inspired countless careers. Marion started her career in food advocacy in 1976 and founded the first academic food studies program in the country at NYU. Marion hopped on the phone with me to review her career and to say that she is definitely not slowing down. In the case of food politics, is the more things change, the more they stay the same?
I think in some ways yes and in some ways no. I mean, in some ways there have been enormous changes. Look at the number of people who are interested in food issues now as compared to 40 years ago. I mean, it's not even comparable. I mean, there were 40 years ago there was Francis Moore Lappe, there was the beginning of Center for Science in the Public Interest, and there were a few people way ahead of their time who were writing about the politics of food, but now everybody is. places.
Yeah, I remember when I first started doing this show 20 years ago and people would think that it was a show about recipes. And I would say, no, we talk about lots of different things like food politics. And people would say, food
What's
politics?
That? What's that? Right, exactly. Now, I mean, most people know what it is now. Food is a $1 trillion industry. The most important public health problems in the world are not having enough food, having too much food, and the effect of our food system on agricultural sustainability and climate change. I mean, these are enormous issues.
I'm curious about how you first started the food studies program at NYU. Did you have a template or were you creating something brand new?
Oh, it came out of my head, and to this day, I can't really explain where it came from. But I had been hanging around with Old Ways Preservation and Exchange Trust, which is how I think we met. And I was talking to a lot of chefs, food writers, and people in the food business. And lots of people were telling me that they wish they knew more about food in a more systematic way. They wish they knew more food history. They wish they knew, understood food anthropology. They wish they knew more about the politics of food and the business aspects of food. And so that was all percolating in the back of my mind when a program in my NYU department was taken away from us and moved into another school. That's the way NYU works. And so that was a big revenue stream that got taken away from us. Everybody was really feeling sorry for us. And when the dean called me in and said, how are you going to feel about having these programs taken away? I said, well, it depends on what I get. And she said, what do you want? And I said, food studies. It was just there. And she said, what's that? And we were off and running. And we went from concept, we're going to do a program in food studies, to state approval in 9 months, and then had this phenomenal stroke of luck. The New York Times wrote about it the week after it was approved by the state, and we had a class. We had people in our office that afternoon saying, I've waited all my life for this program, and now everybody has them.
Wow. So let's also talk about some of the biggest food issues that were facing the country at the time compared to now. I mean, I think we think about that time as being a kinder, gentler time, but it was already on a sort of continuum, right?
Well, it was right in the middle. This was mid-1996. And 1996 was sort of right in the middle of the period when obesity was becoming a problem, but people didn't really recognize it. And it was pretty clear that a lot of things were going on in the food area that hadn't been seen before. And I was starting to write about these topics, and I know that in the late 90s, I wrote about soft drink pouring rights contracts, the contracts that soft drink companies were doing with colleges, high schools, junior high schools, and even grammar schools for exclusive sales of their products in those schools, turning them into agencies that would try to promote consumption of soft drinks in the schools. That was kind of amazing, and that was going on then. And there was a lot of interest at the time in children's eating patterns and marketing to children and other kinds of things. And then in the early 2000s, of course, then you had Eric Schlosser and Fast Food Nation, which I think really changed, was a game changer.
How do you deal with frustration and maybe even occasional rage at the glacial rate of change in the food space?
Well, first of all, I don't see it as glacial. I mean, to me, the change has been very rapid. So if you look back 20 years, it's one of the advantages of being old is you have a longer trajectory to look at things. You know, when I started out in this, hardly anybody was interested in food. You know, we were the only food studies program in the country. There was a program in gastronomy at Boston University, but we were the only real academic program, undergraduate, master's, doctoral programs in food studies. Now everybody has them. They're everywhere. There's several in New York City. That's my personal example of how much things have changed. Supermarkets have better food than they did 20 years ago. A wider variety, better, fresher food. Fruits and vegetables are in much more abundance, and there are many more kinds. There's more organics. There are more CSAs. There are more farmers' markets. There are more people interested in a better audience, demanding food that's healthier for people and the planet. I think that's huge.
That's NYU professor Marian Nessel. We've been talking about her long career as a leading advocate for nutrition and food justice. Finally, we close with a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Take us away, Laura Avery.
I'm so excited today to be standing here visiting with Nick Irvin, who is chef at a relatively new restaurant downtown in the Row called Rappahannock Oyster Bar.
Yeah.
Nick, you were well known as a vegan chef.
Yes, I did the vegan vegetable thing.
The vegan vegetable thing. And then yeah. You took some time off, and now you're downtown at the Row, and now you have an oyster bar. And you're shopping for what today?
I'm shopping for plums, okay. For my hamachi dish.
Plums are a little trickier than peaches and nectarines because they've got that bitter skin. They've got that kind of tartness near the pit. They got the dark skin. They got the surprising colored flesh. So how do you select a plum?
Well, each application is obviously different. For this one, I'm serving with raw hamachi with some serrano chilies, some radishes, some burnt orange oil, and some pickled garlic ponzu sauce. So I like them a little bit sweet, but kind of tart. And I just tasted some from Andy's Orchards, which are delish. Right. Which I'm going to get.
And what's he got today? What variety?
The Santa Rosas. They're okay. Super pretty. Nice sweetness. Nice crunch, if you will.
Yeah, Santa Rosa plums, and plums in general, I think a lot of people think of it just making jam.
Yeah. I had actually, never had real plums until I moved to California. I grew up in, Wyoming, eating, the canned plums, the plums and the jam. And then when I was in, when I moved here when I was 16, I actually moved to Fresno. And I had to walk to school, and I'd walk through this orchard in the middle of the summer to school. And so I walked through it, and I picked up a plum off the tree. And I was it was my first time having a real super sun ripe thing. It was that scene in Ratatouille with all the things go off in his brain. That's kind of what it was like.
Right.
It was really cool.
Right. So let's talk about your dish.
Okay. So it's sliced hamachi.
This is fresh seafood.
Yes, fresh fish. We slice it, and I put some sliced plums on it on top. Shaved watermelon radishes, sliced serrano chilies, and then I dress it with a little bit of pickled garlic ponzu. So I take garlic and soy sauce and vinegar and some chilies, and I mix them all together, and I let them sit out for 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. So I dress it with that, and then I dress it with some burnt orange oil, which I peel oranges and then burn the peels in the oil. And it gets this really kind of almost Christmassy kind of quality to it, which is nice. You'd think that it'd become kind of bitter, but actually does the opposite. It's very aromatic. So dress it with that, and then a little bit of shiso, and a little fleur de sel. It's really good, very light, very summery. I sell a ton of it.
Yeah, as an appetizer?
Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. I think people should come down, because it's really, really good.
Yeah, and it sounds like that wonderful sauce you're putting on your hamachi dish would go with a bunch of other...
If people want that on oysters, we put it on oysters. Yeah. It's kind of a good all-purpose sauce.
Yeah. So the rest of the menu, is it a seafood focused?
It's pretty seafood focused. Uh-huh. I mean, we have a pretty big raw bar, but there's also I've got a really good burger on the menu. You know, I got a great fried chicken. Things sort of lean slightly southern.
Yeah.
Because it's a company that's sort of based in Virginia. We have some southern restaurants, but it's definitely through a sort of Los Angeles lens. Mm-hmm. It's a very Los Angeles restaurant, I think.
Yeah.
Bright, open, airy.
Yeah.
We do a lot of pickles.
A lot of pickles.
Yeah.
That's everybody's doing pickles.
Everyone's doing pickles.
That was Nick Irvin, and he is the chef at Rappahannock Oyster Bar, which is located downtown in The Row, next to where American Apparel used to be, and it just looks like a real exciting place to go explore and eat some great food. I'm talking now with David Karp, and David Karp is familiar to most everybody as a writer, a prolific writer and expert, and probably doing most of the cutting-edge research these days on rare fruit varieties. We could go on and on about his writing career, but today David is on the other side of the table. He actually has a small ownership stake in Andy's Orchard, and he has his own proprietary orchard near Andy's Orchard, which we'll talk about a little bit. David is a man who planted an orchard based on his love and his knowledge of the best fruit in the world. And that's why we love listening to David write, and we love to have him here at the market. So now, David, you got your Andy's Orchard hat on today, and you're providing beautiful, delicious fruit from Andy's Orchard to your adoring customers. Tell us a little bit about the plums you grow.
Well, we had classic Santa Rosa plums today. That's curious because a lot of dark plums are sold to Santa Rosa, even when they're a daughter variety or a cousin variety. which are generally not quite as good, people were coming over and sniffing our Santa Rosas, and the aromatics were just wafting off of those. So for those who may be young and not know what a Santa Rosa is, Santa Rosa was bred by the greatest plant breeder of the late 19th and early 20th century, Luther Burbank. That was his leading creation. It was like 40% of the California plum market. He created the California plum market, basically, by importing varieties from Japan and breeding them. Santa Rosa actually was said to have part of a Native American plum, and you can taste that astringency and sourness next to the skin and next to the flesh. And it does best, you can grow anywhere, but it does best, it preserves its acidity and grows largest in intermediate coastal valleys, such as Andes Orchard is located in Morgan Hill, south of San Jose, which is to stone fruit basically what Napa is to wine, where it's warm enough during the day to sweeten the fruit and cool enough at night so it stays on long enough to develop full size, color, and flavor.
Mm-hmm. Altogether, how many kinds of plums do you grow?
Maybe 40 different varieties of plums, many of them European varieties. Now, what is a European plum? Well, everybody's familiar with the French prune plum. That's the prune of commerce that's dried generally, although occasionally sold fresh. Then we're famous for our greengages. We had a bumper crop last year. Greengage, small, greenish, English, French, unprepossessing, the sweetest fruit in the world, one-third sugar, mm-hmm. with counterbalancing acidity and a distinctive flavor that's like eating jam. We've got all sorts of oddball other plums that often don't even make it to the table because there's like only one and some eagle-eyed chef scoops it up. But the public, by the way, can get on our mailing list. Come up to me. I'm the guy with that spreadsheet the size of Nebraska. Write your name on the back and you'll get the newsletter every Monday. That's the way to gain access to the best, or at least to know what's going to be there so you can get there at 8:30. Sometimes we've got a lot of fruit until noon. Mm-hmm. Other times we're dribbling along after 10 o'clock.
All right, now Andy's Orchard, altogether, just tell us again, because it always blows me away. How many varieties total?
Well, we've got 13 pages on our cert with maybe 22 each. So what is that, like 300 or something like that? Andy's been collecting fruit, traveling abroad, and breeding his own varieties. Mm-hmm. Peaches, apricots, nectarines, plums. And he's been growing fruit with his family since he was born, basically. Mm-hmm. They've been growing fruit since 1930 or so.
And you discovered him when you were writing an article.
For Savour about apricots. I asked the apricot board, hey, who really is an apricot connoisseur? They said, only one man, Andy Mariani. I met him in 1992. We've been friends ever since. I decided in 2006 to put up some money on a charitable basis to establish an orchard of heirloom fruits, the Bunyard Orchard. And then I said, hey, let's just plant this for an economic orchard. Call me crazy, but it's been fun. I can't say it's been particularly lucrative, but I've certainly brought a lot of great fruit to a lot of satisfied people.
That was David Karp. Most of the year, he's a mild-mannered, knowledgeable, erudite reporter. For a few months in the summer, you can find him on the other side of the table over here at Andy's Orchard, and he's selling the fruit. And as you heard just now, waxing eloquent about the beautiful, tasty fruit that he grows up in Morgan Hill. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Head over to the Good Food blog for more from Chef Nick Irvin. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any part of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And if you dug the show, leave us a review. We always value hearing from you. Many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.